Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this evening's lecture. This is the 15th annual lecture of the Hellenic Observatory. The Observatory is a research unit here at the LSE within the European Institute. And for our annual lectures, we've been very pleased over the years to host a variety of speakers, prime ministers, cabinet ministers, bankers, central bank governors, but also we maintain space, of course, for leading international public intellectuals and academics. And our speaker this evening admirably fills the latter category of being such an outstanding international academic. Michael Hertzfeld is known to many of you, I know, for his extensive contributions in the fields of anthropology and related subjects. Michael is the Ernest Monrad Professor of the Social Sciences in the Anthropology Departments at Harvard University, where he's taught since 1991, I understand. He started very young. His standing is also reflected in his affiliations with other universities around the world, in Leiden, Melbourne, and Shanghai. Michael's written some 11 books and, of course, numerous articles. Along the way, he's managed to be the producer of two ethnographic films. His output, in short, is stunning in its breadth as well as its depth. In recent times, Michael has pursued research on the discourses and practices of crypto-colonialism, and I guess tonight's lecture is to be seen in that context. Before I hand over to Michael, can I just simply encourage you to look at our events page and consider coming to our future lectures. In fact, next Tuesday, in this very lecture theatre, we have the Minister of Finance, Evtedis Zakholotos, to come and speak. I understand all tickets for that have now gone. But do please consider our future events programme. We try to have a varied set of lectures and seminars on contemporary Greece and Cyprus. Can I, just before passing over, note that, of course, organization of these kind of events is quite demanding, and the success of our public events program owes much to my colleague, Calliope Liuta. And can I ask you to join me in simply congratulating her? We have a very good team, and we're very grateful to her. We've invited Michael to speak for about an hour, so basically as long as he wishes, and then we will take the remaining period of the time for questions and answers and discussion. Can I just note to Michael and everyone else that the lecture is being recorded, and subsequently it will be available as a podcast to download. So without further ado, can you please join me in welcoming our lecturer this evening, Professor Michael Hertzfeld.
Do I have a way of advancing it myself, or do I perfect it? Wonderful.
Thank you very much indeed, Kevin, and thank you all for coming tonight. I'm going to do something that those of you who know me well will find very surprising. I actually have a text to read, and the reason for this is that I have a rather elaborate argument, although I think it will be pretty clear, and also because there is some possibility of being able to publish it in the near future. So your questions and feedback will indeed be very helpful to me. It has become customary to deride the modern Greeks for failing to live up to their obligations to the international creditors, for being riddled with corruption, and for being lazy and feckless. I hasten to add, those are not my views. Such generic attacks only become useful to understanding the complexities of the crisis, as it's known in Greece, when redeployed as the objects of an ethnographic analysis. In other words, rather than taking them literally or dismissing them as ugly stereotypes, which they certainly are, we should approach them as material for a critical examination of the political space in which the Greek nation state has suffered misrepresentation. Let me be very clear. I have never shied away from criticizing Greek policies when they have struck me as being incompatible with human dignity, Greek or otherwise. The record will bear me out, especially in my criticisms of the Greek state's treatment of the ethnic minorities that astonishingly it still in the year 2015 cannot bring itself to recognize. I've hardly been an apologist for the Greek nation state. I have, however, pointed out that some of the responsibility for the Greek state's bad behavior in this regard has to be borne by the so-called great powers, who effectively pushed what had been a linguistic and religious identity into a territorial entity, a buffer zone between East and West, and at the same time taught its inhabitants that the only possible source of legitimacy for them would be the model of classical Attica designed by German philologists and art historians in the 50 years or so before Greece emerged as a nation state. A model to which they might aspire, but to which, as the imperial operators made sure, they could never hope to attain. The idea that Macedonia was, is, and always will be Greek may stretch credulity, perhaps not in this room, but in many other places, but it's not, in fact, exclusively of the Greeks' own making. The traces of its disparate ethnic origins, especially in the diaspora, tell a story that, while it makes nonsense of Greek claims to an exclusive lien on the name and identity of Macedonia, also makes it quite clear that the origins of that egregious simplification of history do not only lie with the modern Greeks. They are an extension of the vicarious irredentism whereby the great powers used Greece to map out the frontier between imperial Europe and a feared and despised Oriental otherness. I use the word map advisedly. Let me explain by now. How do I do this? Well, next, I guess. Yes.
Oh, yeah.
There, it does work. Good. Now you know it's a really academic performance. Let me explain by adverting to a comparison with a very distant country, but partially in preparation for what will follow later in this presentation when I talk about crypto-colonialism. Thailand, or as it was formerly known, Siam. Just as the Western powers persuaded or forced the Siamese kingdom to allow Western cartographers to map out what the Thai historian Tongtai Winitakun calls the geobody, Greece, hitherto a confessional and linguistic community intermingled with many others, was easily persuaded to accept the principle that territorial integrity was the key to political redemption. Folklorists operating in the service of the nascent nation-state began to think territorially. It's hardly coincidental that an apogee of this kind of thinking came during the Cold War, and especially in the context of the Greek Civil War, with the kind of diffusionist theories that led Yorgios Megas, for example, to argue that if the Balkan countries had houses that looked vaguely like the ancient Greek Megaron, then the Megaron in ancient times must be the point of origin. And we see also very similar kinds of mapping going on all through the Balkans, not just in the case of Greece. Now, the similarity between these two countries is not coincidental. Both exemplify the dynamics of what I call crypto-colonialism. Claims to independence, grounded in an idiom of cultural and territorial integrity, and here comes the irony, largely modeled on Western exemplars and restricted by the practical needs and intentions of the Western colonial powers, and developing into internal forms of colonialism. So Cyprus in the Greek case and the Muslim South in the Thai case. These served, inter alia, as a means of reifying ever more rigidly the premise of a homogeneous national culture and the contrivedly heroic story of its self-emancipation under an increasingly controversial monarchical system. Greece, at least, has managed to achieve a more convincing form of political imagination, largely, I would argue, thanks to the improbably imaginative and proactive intervention of the elder Constantine Karamanlis, a once classic Cold Warrior who in a few short years succeeded in restoring and enhancing parliamentary democracy, abolishing the linguistic albatross of Katharevosa with its repressive implications for those who are on the economic and cultural margins of the country, sending the monarchy to an appropriately ignominious demise far more decisive than the rigged so-called plebiscite set up by the junta of 1967-74, legalizing the Communist Party of Greece and therefore depriving it of its romantic associations and making certain that it would never become again a majority party, or could never become a majority party, and ensuring that the parliamentary opposition under the son of his old nemesis, the elder George Papandreou, won the national elections of 1981, and so stabilizing the political party alternation so vital, as he understood, to establishing a genuine democracy. I would argue that Greece, in fact, today has one of the most vibrant and successful democracies to be found anywhere in the world. And proof of that is the fact that they were able to elect an opposition government in the face of the crisis that the country is now undergoing. So the achievement echoes again in the recent victories of Syriza under Alexis Tsipras. The elder Karamanlis probably wouldn't have liked Tsipras very much, but he would have applauded the political freedom that his victories portended. I would even add that the distressing electoral successes of the Chrysiavgi, Golden Dawn, and I speak as somebody who's actually been vilified online by that neo-Nazi cabal, represents a victory of sorts for the democratic ideal. Far better that their ideas should surface and trigger the dynamics of collective embarrassment and retaliation than that they should fester in those secret conclaves where plots and putches can be hatched. Thailand, which is not my subject here, has of course been less fortunate, and we know that today Thailand is in the grip of a vicious military regime disguised as a caretaker and technocratic government. Greeks, and especially the bullies of the Troika, should look at the Thai case in comparative perspective and should understand how fortunate Europe has been that its interventions in Greece have largely failed. Thailand today grapples with life under a military junta that treats the populace as an ailing patient that has to be saved from communist subversion, short skirts, and humor. That sounds familiar, doesn't it, for those of us who were alive in the 67-74 period? It's a familiarly bitter potion. Greece is today in a very different condition. Its apparent failures and its refusal to play the EU's game are marks of a rebelliousness that could be used as an excuse for suppressing its desire for real independence. We see some stirrings of that tendencies in the rhetoric of conservative op-eds and the comments made by German and other politicians. But that may also be a refreshing sign of genuine refusal to accept definitions of the national self that happen to suit the European leadership. I'm going to go further today and argue that the very distress of the Greek polity today may yet save the whole continent from the control of unelected European and culturally essentialist organizations of which the European Union is the most inclusive. I speak not as a politician, not as a political scientist, not as an economist, but as a social anthropologist. I see my task as that of asking what the role of cultural management has been in forcing Greece into a role that has served it so badly, or served the Greeks so badly. I'm going to argue that the EU has practiced a form of vicarious fatalism that's somehow imposed from outside, analogous to the vicarious irredentism I've already mentioned. And I'm going to suggest that this reproduces a long-standing historical pattern, more or less the situation that I've already described as crypto-colonial. And I'm going to suggest that Greece's success in resisting this two centuries long imposition of a neoclassical model of its history can, and you'll see shades of a feminist theoretical orientation here, can liberate the oppressors as much as the oppressed and put pain to the nonsense that there is some sort of essential European culture, if only we knew where and how to find it. When Ekaterini declares, "We will stay on as Europe," closest I can get to Θα μείνουμε Ευρώπη, which is actually more essential even than the English. This above a photograph that shows anxious citizens lining up at ATMs to get what they probably thought would be their last euros. We can see all too clearly the force of stereotypes and essentialism. Despite those devices, culture is not a thing. It is a process. That statement is a mantra of modern social and cultural anthropology. Its reification, that is, culture's reification, in museum displays and dioramas is the product of a particular form of conceptual labor and serves to displace the dynamics of everyday life with its creativity and performativity in favor of a static image that serves the interests of state power. And no matter whether you go to national museums in Greece or Turkey or Thailand or Korea, wherever it happens to be, you'll see the same story, which suggests that these are not, in fact, expressions of real independence so much as reproductions of a hegemonic model. I don't necessarily need to invoke the soft power concept of culture popularized by my Harvard colleague Joseph Nye. Nye has unquestionably identified a favorite technique of great power politics in which straightforward militarism and intervention no longer work, but can sometimes be substituted by a familiar metaphor, the Trojan horse of cultural diplomacy. My argument has more to do with what Chris Shaw has identified as a sustained but largely unsuccessful attempt by the EU bureaucracy to implant a collective cultural consciousness in the mindset of constituent nations, to say there is such a thing as European culture and we have it and we're going to make it. Anthropologists have been, and have long been for that matter, skeptical of attempts to attribute states of mind to whole populations. They don't accept that one can win hearts and minds because there's no practical way of knowing whether the obsequious bowings and scrapings of subaltern groups disguise anything more than resentment or a deeply ironical sense of how gullible the powerful can in fact be. They've also challenged the reduction of national identity to national character, which we hear in Greek under the term nootropia. So when Greeks talk of their national mentality, anthropologists will usually see in such formulations precisely what I mean by vicarious fatalism, or if you will, a dangerously addictive form of determinism, the doctrine that says one can't do anything about the mess that others have created because that's the way we are anyway. That doesn't get us out of the mess. So this is why Greeks often get accused of refusing to accept responsibility for their own actions. They recognize this proclivity in themselves. I think within this room, probably there's not a single Greek person present who would not understand that ethnophobia is seen as part of the negative self-stereotype, that is, fear of taking responsibility, as part of the negative self-stereotype that Greeks entertain, shall we say, kekis menon ton thiron, in other words, in camera, but not for the eyes of outsiders. That's why anthropologists, by the way, are such a nuisance, because they always want to know what people don't want them to know. Now, all of us who've lived in Greece have come across examples of ethnophobia. We could have a nice time over dinner trading stories about it. It becomes an excuse in itself. If we are ethnophobi by nature, we can hardly be blamed for refusing to accept our responsibility for the mess. Everything, so the rhetoric goes, is the result of that interfering xenodactyl, the foreign finger. This is the worst aspect of cultural essentialism. It can paralyze reform, not, let me insist again, because ethnophobia represents genuinely an ineradicable part of the Greek national character, I'm arguing that there is no such thing as a Greek or any other kind of national character, but because it's extraordinarily handy for those who, for all sorts of self-interested reasons, do not wish to countenance real reform. And you can all name your favorite politicians as guilty of that. They may be individuals or groups, but they profit from the inertia that such a self-image produces. Add to that the self-image of a people who define themselves as rebellious by nature, and one can see that this concatenation is convenient, not only for its local operators, mostly conservative politicians, but for those foreign governments, banks, and monetary institutions that would prefer a humble Greece to an economically self-sufficient or even self-assertive one. At this juncture, I want to emphasize two points that I consider very important. First of all, this is not an anti-EU and still less an anti-German rant. I recognize that the operators of the EU and of all of its constituent nation states are not cut from the same cloth, that they exercise many, sometimes conflicting forms of agency. But I ask why, if we can recognize this, we find it so difficult to accord the Greeks the same courtesy, seeing in them the same mixture of I don't want to call it good and bad because I want to avoid judgmental language, but the same mixture of functional and dysfunctional dimensions. There's clearly a disparity between the criteria used to judge those with power and the criteria used to judge those who do not have power. That's particularly true, as I hope to demonstrate later on in this talk, of the way in which some Western European politicians assume the right to criticize Greece for practices in which, both historically and in the present, they are themselves deeply and dishonorably implicated. The second point is a call for the paradoxical stance that I have identified in my own discipline of social anthropology as a militant middle ground. That may sound nonsensical, but I've tried to make some sense of it. In social anthropology, it effectively means trying to avoid the equally solipsistic logics of extreme postmodernism, anything's a text, so everything's a text, so whatever I say goes, and extreme positivism, well, if you can't measure it, it isn't there, as if your ability to measure it was the only measure of its existence. These are both arguments that run into the ground because they are totally solipsistic. To say that something should not be considered important because we can only see it inchoately, through a glass darkly, as it were, is ridiculous. Our own incapacities and the vagueness of much social life should not be taken as a basis for saying these things don't exist. But to say that everything I write is textual and therefore equally valid is equally absurd. Both these attitudes, of course, as I describe them now, are caricatures, but few serious scholars today actually embrace either extreme. But there's a reason for using caricatures, because in fact what we discover is that caricatures are a large part of what the political dispute revolves around. So this is why I call for a militancy of the middle ground. Without it, the center cannot hold. Academics, however, are nominally at least committed to reason and moderation, at least most of them, I would think. Perhaps that's why so few people listen to them these days. Achieving a grip on a balanced and dialectical middle ground is, however, infinitely harder in geopolitics, where it seems caricatures are not only acceptable, but a coin of the realm. Greek cartoons depicting Angela Merkel as a Nazi and German cartoons depicting the Greeks as failed offspring of that glorious Hellenic past are equally silly, but they play a visible role in the media war that accompanies what we somewhat implausibly, at least in the case of Mr. Schäuble and Mr. Varoufakis, call diplomacy. And it is equally nonsensical to say either the Greeks are hapless victims or to blame poor Europe exclusively for the current crisis. The moralism of Western diatribes against Greece allows for no middle ground, while the neo-nationalism of almost all Greek politicians, while understandable, tends to reinforce the other Europeans' prejudices against the Greeks as crazed hyper-nationalists. Prejudices that, in a more reasonable world, might have been recognized in Michael Billig's argument as an exotic phenomenon, a warning against essentializing all Balkan peoples as ineluctably nationalistic by nature. And this, again, is an argument that brings back that notion, that biogenetic notion of what people's collective character is like, which is a concept that is, I think, logically indefensible. Such tactics lock the debate into the infertile zone of essentialist insult trading. But the insult trading is objectively interesting, and that's what I want to focus on. I want to use anthropological and historical insights to suggest a more productive path to, yes, a militant middle ground. Perhaps if we can see the parallels between the epistemological and the cultural battles, with their surprisingly similar lurches into unreason, we may be able to draw back from the gaping void that would occur with the kind of humiliation with which Greece is currently and frequently threatened. First, then, the history. For the language of European moralism did not spring fully formed, if I may use an appropriately neoclassical metaphor, from the head of Zeus. Not without reason, some of the apologists of the European Union have insisted that it's a Christian organization. Not, I suggest, because Europe is Christian. That's a purely essentialist position, and I might say there's nothing more dangerous in the English language than the word is, but because both administratively and ideologically it derives much of its authority from a distinctively Catholic modus operandi, and Douglas Holmes has demonstrated how the bureaucratic structure of the EU is in fact modeled on that of the Vatican. The language of corruption is itself redolent of eschatology, of the corruption of the flesh, in contrast to the eternal perfection, the absence of which the secular theodicy of Western democracy attempts to explain away. Moreover, Greece has long been portrayed, and here I must admit that anthropologists bear some of the blame, as a place where familistic ideals have held sway, leaving little space for any possibility of reform. But are those ideals typically Greek, or even typically Mediterranean? Greek anthropologist Alexandra Bakalaki argued some years ago that their origins lay partly in the Victorian morality of the so-called protector powers during the heyday of colonialism, so that their re-representation of signs of backwardness are a classic example of the relegation of an entire country to a time inherently and ineluctably severed from modernity. Whose interests did such representation serve? The problem here is, once again, we're too easily captivated by easy essentialisms, by the idea that certain ways of thinking about morality are typically Greek, even when reflection and historical knowledge might lead us to see that we share at least some of those values to whom we attribute them. Ideals of patriarchy, of the value of female chastity, of honorable behavior, and of the need for revenge are all present in the West as much as in Greece or the Mediterranean. Indeed, on the question of revenge, we can see a long history from 19th century dueling to the current rhetoric of victims' rights in murder cases in the United States. But the point of making that separation is that then, by saying we don't practice revenge, we are not patriarchal, etc., etc., this allows us to feel superior and to use that, and it allows us to use that feeling of superiority for political purposes. How can one take seriously a country? So the implied question goes, where honor killings still occur, where women are often segregated from men and usually treated as inferior, and where family values trump civic propriety. You only have to listen to Republican right-wingers talking about family values in the United States to see how absurd it is to say family values are only something that are relevant to the Greeks. Now, can anyone seriously and honestly claim that this description doesn't apply in equal measure to some of the most powerful Western countries, including, as I've just indicated, the United States? The question perhaps should better be reformulated. We're not asking the unquantifiable question, corruption barometers notwithstanding, of where bribery and nepotism are at their greatest, but that of which countries have the power to say so and simultaneously disguise their own involvement, not only in similar practices, but also in the countries where they accuse of being so wicked. To make the point with an example to which I'm going to return in a moment, this is not only about Volkswagen, this is about Siemens. I'm not, let me make clear, denying the reality of these practices in Greece. That would be merely foolish, and it would actually be at odds with what I'm describing as the militant middle ground. I am advocating here, and I've already documented the importance of ethnophobia in Greek life, a position that understands and represents the responsibility of all the parties to these disputes. We should carefully examine the credentials and past and present involvement in Greece of those countries that are particularly active in charging Greece with such sins against democratic ideals. After all, what better way to tarnish the reputation of the so-called cradle of democracy? But to answer that effectively, it would be helpful to explore the relationship between the values that these self-appointed EU moralists are invoking on the one hand and the values of ordinary Greek people on the other. This is my second tier, a recognizably anthropological one. Here, in fact, we should look at those segments of Greek society that seem to embody the most extreme or unmixed of those attitudes that have been portrayed as typical. What we find, I suggest, is that Greeks and West Europeans alike have long been engaged in very similar discourses about obligation, credit, honorable behavior, and, in this neoliberal age, competition. That fact has been obscured by two things. The first is a tendency to see Greek rural social values as exotic, perhaps the result, as John Davis has argued, of a desire to keep up with the anthropological Joneses, in other words, to be as exotic as any Africanist or Melanesianist. The corollary is the indignation with which educated Greeks used to greet the information that one was conducting anthropological research in their country. They would say, "We are not savages." Despite their claims not to be racists, moreover, claims that Golden Dawn is very successfully undermining, many Greeks have in fact assimilated such attitudes, which may explain why my comparison of Greece with an Asian country, namely Thailand again, was met with a stony silence even while it was quickly embraced by leading Thai intellectuals. And it's also diagnostic, I think, that after 2009, suddenly that model was beginning to be appreciatively used by Greek scholars. Now, Bakalaki's historical observations about the commonalities shared by Greek and Victorian societies gives us an excellent point of access. While it would clearly be an exaggeration to say that Greek concepts of honor and all the rest actually derived from West European values, the Ottoman Empire did not interfere as much as one might suppose with the conceptual trading that has produced such convergences. It's not my purpose here to trace those convergences to their actual origins, but they are striking enough to be worth considering as part of the context of current geopolitical disputes. I first began to think about such matters when I listened to George Bush I and Saddam Hussein attacking each other. They were clearly invoking the same symbolic language. And indeed, as Anton Bloch pointed out in 1981, the honor of nations, including very clearly Western nations, is modeled on the same code that produced the complex Mediterraneanists used to simplify as honor and shame. The agonistic relations that are said to characterize rural Greek communities are surely recognizable in that most outrageously anti-authoritarian village of Zonyana, where I did fieldwork in the 1970s and 1980s, where people actually pointed to the proliferation of coffee houses. There were 29 cafenea for a population of 1,450 at one point, as an example of capitalism in practice based on competition for the favors of patrons who were powerful because they were good at stealing sheep and goats and at being protected by conservative politicians. And I'll have a little more to say about that in a moment as well. Moreover, nation states are always modeled on kinship groups. They supersede more restricted groups, but the only aspects that make them less familistic than Greek or Italian villagers are those of scale and a concept of common good. Moreover, even the most idealistically regulated state must deal with a few bad apples, and one is tempted to say, are they actually so few? What I want to suggest here is that no state, can ever function on the basis of perfect legality. And nations actually work better when the state winks at moderately illegal practices. Maybe some of you are going to rethink your tax forms as a result of this. This is the argument I make about cultural intimacy, but it's also implicit, for example, in James Scott's analysis of the British work to rule. Hans Steinmüller has recently shown that even, or perhaps especially, such a centralized state as China can only really work if the functionaries of the state connive at various practices that are deemed to be inappropriate, backward, or downright crooked. And I'm not talking about spectacular cases like the Bochi Lai affair, nor am I talking about corruption in the formal sense. I'm talking about the pragmatics of actual governance, in which a flexible attitude is best maintained through the appearance of a rigid law and morality, because successful operators use that apparent rigidity to disguise their practical adaptations, just as we all do in any moral system. In this respect, I suggest Greeks are no different from the citizens of other states. So then why are they castigated for what everyone else does? I suggest that neoliberalism, the dominant economic ideology associated with EU managerial practices, looks for failures to bolster its authority. Just as at the individual level, the economically weak go to the war, no welfare for them, economically fragile countries are represented as deserving the precariousness that is now their lot. Greece, for example. This stems directly from the logic that Richard Handler identified as possessive individualism. If the culture that is our inalienable possession is flawed, then we as collective individuals must pay the price. Conservative commentators inside Greece are apt to articulate this argument, which faithfully reproduces that of their own patrons, or of those who at least used to be their patrons, in the chancelleries of Western Europe and North America. What this means in practice is that not only do bank economists set up self-fulfilling prophecies about the fate of the economy in general, as Douglas Holmes has argued, but Greece, a client state, is in a weak position. I don't say no position, it can do something, but it's in a weak position to resist the temptations of wealth, consumer goods, and final acceptance, as Greeks largely hoped, as European. Indeed, at the height of the boom, when the Olympic Games had just concluded in Athens in 2004, I came out to the front of the new airport and was surprised to see everybody standing in a very orderly line waiting for taxis. And when I said, but how is this possible? What happened to all of those little old ladies who would bop you on the head to get you out of the way? Two people turned to me and said very haughtily, Kyrie, tora idam Evropei, sir, now we have become European. Well, you can't get much more crypto-colonial than that. There's also little that is soft about this use of power, of culture as power, and perhaps that's a further point in favor of mentioning that incident. German engagement with Greece has a deep history. Not only was the Othonian monarchy the cap on a North European attempt to reclassicize the country through a mixture of architecture and administration, but the famous Evzones, originally a military guard intended to associate the monarchy with a highly selective image of, now let's see if we can get it to do what, okay. So there are the, now there's the monarchy. Now this doesn't look like the Greek monarchy, and it isn't, okay? But you'll see my point in a moment, because these are the two crypto-colonial monarchies, right? First one, the Siamese one, where you have the King Rama V, the great westernizer in a western military uniform, and then something that is said to be traditionally Thai, but actually owes a great deal more to Cambodian, Khmer culture. And then we see the same thing happening with Otho, the German first king of the Hellenes, who is portrayed again in a western uniform and wearing a fustanella, which at that time was worn by far more Albanian speakers than Greek speakers. So I think that does make a strong argument for the comparison. Now it's not behaving. Aho, nothing to do with me. Let's see, try again. Nope. Ah, I've got it. Don't worry, thank you. Thank you very much. And then you look at the Evzones today, okay, the monarch has disappeared. You still have the Fustanella, two different photographs, but notice what they're doing. That military drill, which tourists come to see because it's said to be quintessentially the expression of modern Greece, traditional costume, and a military drill that is redolent of Greek history. Yes, it's the German goose-step, which is actually prohibited in Germany because of its association with Nazism. So I think you see very clearly there the kind of logic that that crypto-colonialism produces in both countries. So the current face-off between Germany and Greece reproduces some of the contradictions and ironies of Greece's early relationship with the Germanic states. But one key component of this remarkable history has changed. In the early years of independence, Germany had not yet emerged as a nation-state of its own, in its own right, although romantic notions of national culture were percolating from the likes of the preeminent German philosopher of nationalism, Johann Gottfried Herder, to many other places, and with devastatingly rapid effect. In essence, Germany exported its view of national culture long before it could benefit from the concept itself. And Germany was also to disintegrate temporarily in the aftermath of the Nazi regime, while Greece was kept alive, albeit barely, by Germany's enemies during World War II. So Germany was not, until it assumed its current hegemony within the EU, a colonial power in any lasting sense. Instead, its ideas and cultural forms, and especially its rendition of the classical past, became the instrument of another kind of vicariousness, the Western control of Greek interests. That control, however, was to serve Germany well in the long run. Much as one may admire the transformation of Karamanlis, the political tradition with which his early career is associated is marked by that official historiography, by something that official historiography attributes to the pernicious effects of Ottoman bureaucratic practice, but was in reality strongly supported on a quid pro quo basis by the European powers. That something was an extraordinarily ramified system of patronage. Just as Greece is a client of its patrons in the West, so that structure is reproduced all the way down to the local level. The interdependence of Western interests and the practice of Rusfeti is well documented. Most of the politicians most egregiously ensnared in the system, described by my teacher John Campbell in Honor, Family, and Patronage, were members of the conservative establishment. But Campbell described a dual-level system whereby sarakats and shepherds gave cheeses to merchants, who then collected their votes in exchange for such favors as jobs for their own children. In those areas with a patrilineal kinship system, Zonyana is a good example, there was no need for such intermediaries. The shepherds could organize their voting blocks around the sometimes quite large clans they belonged to, from which indeed some of the local politicians who were going to make it big on the national scene were emerging during the post-Civil War years. In one especially notorious case, which I think some people in this audience will recognize, and which produced the sole conviction for bribery ever generated by a local whistleblower, a conservative politician and one-time Minister of Justice, yes, Justice, was caught suborning witnesses in a court case in exchange for electoral support. Another leading politician who baptized literally thousands of local children in exchange for political support eventually became Prime Minister. These cases were the tip of a very large iceberg. I'll leave it to others to pronounce moral judgment. As in an analytical discussion of moralism, it's not my job to do that. I merely point out the connections. But in a society in which values of honor and shame were said to be paramount, to say that Brutus was an honorable man should be sufficient to point out the irony. Rather, what I want to do is remind this audience that the accusations launched against Greece by its critics ring particularly hollow when we consider that the political establishment thus accused of corruption has served the interests of these sanctimonious critics for long decades. I would argue that the practices thus described are not merely the remnants of Ottoman misrule, though they may indeed bear traces of Ottoman influence. The Ottomans, after all, we shouldn't forget, were particularly close to Germany in the final years of their empire. These are also practices sustained by the impunity that comes with powerful protection, protection that itself represents a form of the same set of practices. To put this more bluntly, the system of patron-client relations that have been the subject of many studies in Greece, from Campbell to Mouzelis to Bourdalakis, reproduces the client status of Greece itself in relation to the great powers. And in that relationship, Germany has moved from being a pawn of British and French and later American interests and has become the effective head of a Western coalition still willing to perpetuate the same inequalities, and to do so now not necessarily as a result of direct government intervention, but through the proxy of banks and financial institutions. In the neoliberal age, when national governments arguably no longer have the independence to act alone, as Britain and France largely did in their heyday of empire, Germany's role is diffused throughout the Troika, but its direct interest in the matter is revealed by the prominent and not always concordant views of Schäuble and Merkel, and by a series of evident injustices in their claims about Greece that perhaps intentionally, but perhaps not, have had the effect of shoring up the inequality of their so-called partnership, Synetheria, within the EU. I've mentioned that Greece has a patrilineal system of kinship that facilitates the operation of large clan-based voting blocks. Probably even the anthropologists among you were tempted to go to sleep when I said kinship, because that's something that everybody in anthropology traditionally gets bored with. But actually, if journalists and others would just take a couple of basic lessons in the simple outlines of kinship, they would have explanations for a lot of the things they don't understand. We see something very similar to the mafia organization, the so-called Cosche, producing similar blocks of support and vertical as well as horizontal units of operation. We should also not overlook the fact that virtually all the so-called big families in Greek politics operate in the patrilineal mode, which is why names like Karamanis and Papandreou, neither of which is Cretan, form points of solidarity among the political elite. But that's actually a minor dimension of what I'm describing. So let me now turn to the actual dynamics of the crisis. I speak of three claims that logically should have boomeranged back onto the German banks and government, and more diffusely, the IMF, the ECB, and the core administration of the EU. These are that Greeks are lazy and don't work as hard as other Europeans, Daniel Knight has also addressed the ancillary accusation that they party wildly in cafes and bars while the country goes down the drain. And I might add, they've even been accused of buying Chanel perfumes in bulk, but that's because they've lost faith in the euro and other currency, and they're buying Chanel the way their great-grandparents used to hoard gold sovereigns. Better than going to the bank. The second accusation is that they're irresponsible in their financial dealings and don't respect the moral obligations that come with loans. And the third is that they're riddled with corruption in contrast to their Western protectors. Let me address each one of these briefly in turn. And I'm not going to deny them. So if you're expecting Greece to get whitewashed here, you'll be disappointed. But I think it's something actually much more interesting. So the easiest of these accusations to rebut is the claim that the Greeks worked short hours, since they themselves were quick to point out that using statistics generated by the very Western agencies that had seemed most assiduous in condemning Greece, one can very quickly see that Greece and Austria have the longest formal working hours in Germany, in Europe. Germany is not even close. Some will retort it's not just a question of hours worked, but also of efficiency and productivity. But interestingly enough, in this neoliberal age, those were not the terms of the accusation. Perhaps that's what the neoliberals thought, but it's not what they said. And that itself is suggestive of a certain disingenuousness of this very selective presentation of the facts. The second accusation, that the Greeks acted irresponsible, overlooks the fact that, as even some economists like Paul Krugman and Joseph Stiglitz have pointed out, the German and other bankers who advanced Greece huge loans in the 1980s and 1990s must have known that Greece would never be able to pay those debts. Rather like moneylenders who exercise political power over hapless individuals who then struggle to escape by turning to third, fourth, and fifth usurers, only finding themselves sinking ever deeper into the mire of debt, Greek governments, whose panic is clearly revealed by the concealment of the size of the debt that George Papandreou Jr. finally admitted, fell into this trap. Yes, they were feckless, and perhaps even criminally careless, but their consumerist eagerness to catch up with the West was driven by the very political and economic forces that were now castigating them for allowing it to entrap them in inescapable debt, misery, and poverty. Of course, some ways out of the morass do exist, but they do little to allay Greek suspicions. Whether or not we wish to accede in the view that the rows of photovoltaic panels replacing formerly lush agricultural production are truly the marks of a new colonial invasion, as Daniel Knight's informants insisted, they do represent a huge economic investment in the control of Greek land, and most of them are operated by German firms. As for the third accusation, that Greece is irremediably corrupt, it is surely sufficient to point out that the Siemens conglomerate was twice embroiled in major bribery scandals in Greece, and that the largest bribes to come to Greek officials appear to have originated in Western Europe and, again, mostly in Germany. Now, I'm not trying to say here Germans are just as corrupt as the Greeks. I don't want to get into that line of argument at all. It exemplifies the most childish kind of excuse-making does sometimes come out of Greece. They do it. Why shouldn't we do it too? Such pouting comparisons persuade no one and perhaps even reinforce the impression that the Greeks have something to hide. What I do want to say, however, is that the idea that Western countries are not corrupt while Greece is offers much too simple a picture. They are involved in each other's corruption. It's also significant that the Eurobarometer Corruption Index doesn't really pinpoint actual corruption. It always talks about perceptions of corruption, a very important distinction, because the entire battle at stake is, in fact, all about perceptions. And if we're going to condemn Greece because it is perceived as disproportionately corrupt, should we not also ask why Germany is perceived as less so? The invidious unfairness of the comparison suggests that its failure to figure in public debate has more to do with electoral politics in Germany and the international struggle among all the EU members than it does with reality. And at this point, I just want to... I can do it. I figured out what happens. Okay, and that's the last one, so we don't have to worry. Well, never mind. Anyway, this is the last one. Greeks have understood that these bankers are, in fact, acting exactly as usurers. For those who might not speak Greek in this room, it just says no to local, so they're admitting gilt at home as well, known to local and foreign usurers. I think that's loan sharks. I think that's a very indicative graffiti. So this observation brings me to my concluding remarks, in which I propose to fold back these three basic points about the current portrayal of Greece into a consideration of the implications of what I discussed at the beginning of this presentation, that the language of Greek morality may itself be partly of Western origin, or at least share some history with Western values, and not just in the sense of the cradle of democracy. Western critics today accuse Greece of dishonorable behavior and of a failure, which is an undeniable fact, to live up to its international obligations. There are many Greek commentators who say the same thing about Greece, and hypokreosy is a key core value in Greek society. Let me therefore reiterate that to recognize the partially extraneous origins of that failure is not to exonerate Greece for its backslidings. That's not my purpose. Rather, I suggest we should see the entire dreadful mess as expressive of an entire continent that is now in the grip of an economistic logic that has taken over the entire vocabulary of ethics to the point where it's sometimes difficult to see that value is not always or even necessarily economic. It is here that the common language shared by Greece and its detractors is especially revealing. Anthropologists have, of course, since the time of Campbell, emphasized the central role of the concept of obligation, hypokreosy. But hypokreosy is the very basis of what foreigners decry and deride as corruption, as is honor, the usual Greek term for which is timi, which significantly also means price. And of course, there's the famous saying, timi, timi den echi, ke hara ston pou timi. Honor has no price, the same word, and a joy to whoever has it. Greek traditional wisdom, in other words, recognizes the fungibility, to use an economistic term, of the relationship between these very different kinds of value. As Peter Loizos, the late Peter Loizos, a wonderful colleague and friend who taught for many years in this institution, reminded us many years ago, the concept of friendship, or philia in Greek, similarly doesn't posit an irreducible incompatibility between self-interest and genuine commitment. In fact, it recognizes the contrary. Something very similar happens with Chinese notions of connection, wanqi in Chinese, where only the authorities' desire to look good in the eyes of the rest of the world has brought to what most Chinese is just a system of social relations into disrepute. For Greece, a realistic and radically ethical appreciation of the ways in which commitment and commercial value confuse with each other is also infused with a deep realization that the greater power of money makes this an unequal struggle. A point that Marcel Mauss, thank you, it seems appropriate at this moment to toast Marcel Mauss in any case, in his post-Lapsarian account of the deleterious effects of money on the moral obligations of reciprocity, pointed out at the dawn of modern social science, that money wins out. Money wins hands down because it translates into numbers, numbers translate into power, no matter whether we're talking about banking contracts or electoral calculations made by ministers of justice trading with sheep thieves in the high mountains of West Central Crete. Anthropologists have recognized this ever since Ernestine Friedel in 1962 and John Campbell in 1964 published their ethnographies, and John Peristiani a few years earlier gathered a group of scholars together to speak of honor and shame. While I personally been in the vanguard of those who protested against the oversimplification and regional conflation that the honor and shame scheme of Mediterranean morality produced, I've never denied the centrality of the value so described to the lives of the people who live in this region, or for that matter, to the lives of their self-appointed protectors. Indeed, it was the decoupling of these values from some stereotypical bedrock of Mediterranean identity that was at stake in those earlier debates. And you will recall that stereotypes were very much on my mind as I began this presentation tonight. What we have been witnessing is something that anthropologists have observed in many societies, the material impact of verbal performance. Most recently, and with great originality, Douglas Holmes has argued that bankers themselves act like anthropologists, preparing the way for a well-planned foregone conclusion whenever a serious change in the economic organizations of the world's finances is underway. I want to suggest that something very similar is happening with the status of Greece in the EU. but I also suspect that this will be tripped up by the healthy electoral system that now, as I've said, thanks to the conservative Karamanlis, has produced an opposition victory for the fourth time since the fall of the junta, and a victory of a left-wing party emerging from the shadows for the third time. The din of stereotypes and counter-stereotypes is part of the larger battle, images that may play a role, though not the only determining role in the way the crisis evolves. Meanwhile, we should stand back from the judgmentalism that such rhetorical contests produce. We can then see quite clearly how the language of obligation has been deployed in this unequal struggle. German politicians, moreover, have become increasingly entrapped in their own electoral calculations and realize that the dynamics of Greece bashing have taken on a seemingly ineluctable inevitability, a force that seems to have come out of nowhere and leaves them no choices if they want to stay in office. Ironically, that feeling has been further reinforced by the migrant crisis, a crisis in which, as one Australian headline puts it, Kos sinks under desperate tide of migrants, unquote. But at the same moment as Greece has had to play the role of Europe's border police, at vast cost to a country already struggling with the problems of debt, German politicians are increasingly helpless in the face of demands that they limit immigration and stop bailing out the Greeks. As you reap, so shall you sow. I'm not offering solutions. Rather, what I'm proposing is more in the nature of a pre-solution, a precondition for any solution. If any politically equitable and practically manageable settlement between Greece and its creditors is to be reached, the first order of business is to drag our voyeuristic eyes away from the sordid mess that money has created and to examine critically the role of stereotypes in determining the direction of EU policy toward Greece. By presenting themselves as rational organizations, and thus somehow as above culture, which makes no sense anthropologically, the unelected Troika administrations have arrogated to themselves the right to humiliate an entire country with the attendant risk that their whole financial edifice will collapse and unravel. That serves no one's interests, except perhaps those who are trading on the precarious conditions of increasing numbers of Europeans, and who may then seek to export the same modus operandi to the rest of the world, creating a new form of colonialism that is infinitely crueler than the old one, the regime of what we call structural violence. Indeed, this has already begun to happen. If we can draw attention to the relatively small problem, that is the crisis in Greece today, and show how it's been engineered and whose interests it serves, perhaps, after all, we can do something more for the larger world we all live in. But for that to happen, we must confront the production of stereotypes for the material reality that it is and insist that public discourse recognize the shared language and morality of all the actors in this sorry tale. If we do not do that, nothing will change. If instead we do manage to get both the Greeks and their detractors to see the insults they've been trading as not just a part but as an active producer of the crisis, we will have moved decisively forward. Stereotypes are something that anthropologists customarily criticize as analytical constructs and examine as features of conflict. It's time others listened to our concerns. Indeed, the marginalization of the anthropological voice in this story, as in so much else, is itself symptomatic of the world's refusal to confront the reality of which I've been speaking. Specialists in other social sciences have been able to dazzle the world with calculations that have often proved false. How many economists have produced predictions that actually worked out? And yet, it seems that failure in your predictions is a sure pathway to success in politics. Years ago, in a book called Anthropology Through the Looking Glass, I argued that Greece and anthropology shared the dubious distinction of being marginal entities whose very marginality was the product of the dynamics of colonialism. That's probably truer today than it was even in 1987 when the book came out. It's for that reason that I particularly appreciate the unusual gesture of the Hellenic Observatory in inviting an anthropologist to speak to these painful matters and hope that it may presage a way out of this unproductive, demeaning, and morally indefensible crisis. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael, very much indeed. I imagine there are going to be a number of questions for you. I think we have colleagues, yes, with microphones. Can I invite you to put up your hand and just simply say who you are and ask your questions, and we can start the discussion. Who'd like to go first?
We'll ask people to speak slowly and clearly because I have a hearing.
Okay, yes. So if you can speak slowly and very clearly, please. There's a microphone coming to the gentleman in blue. Sorry, I didn't point out. Constantine.
I can't hear him at all. I'm sorry, I can't hear you at all. Could you stand up? It would actually make it probably easier for others as well. Thank you. I'm not sure it's working, though.
Oh, there's another microphone coming.
Sorry about that.
No, it's a problem for all of us.
My personal technology is not so good, so.
Constantine?
Okay, there we go. Is this better?
Yes, but if you can speak
up. My name is Constantine Buhaya, and I write about Greece and broadcast about Greece. You presented Greece as a construct in many respects, which has been stapled into place since the early 19th century. And then you proceeded to pop a lot of those staples to see what lies beneath it. I'm afraid I couldn't follow all, can I address all the staples you've popped, but just a few of them. You mentioned that the construct of Greece in the early 19th century, political and cultural, and I would like to take you back to the 17th century, in fact, when Constantine Gerakis, Constantine Folkon, who was a Greek who became a prime minister of Thailand, and he was perceived as a Greek, and he's still perceived as a Greek, and he was, to a large extent, responsible for Thailand being less colonialized than other neighboring states. So 17th century as well, when you have correspondents and refugees coming to England, presenting themselves as Greeks, as refugees, wishing to liberate their Greek homeland, wishing to liberate themselves from the Ottoman heathen yoke, and Milton telling them in his correspondence that you are not civilized enough, you're not worthy of your ancient ancestors for us to send an army and liberate you. In other words, there has been a continuous, if we take the 17th century model, desire for Greece to liberate itself, at least from certain people, and perhaps the content has changed. 19th century Greek traders who dominated cotton trade in Britain, jute, khaki, and who had very strong connections with Greece and the political statement, and bringing in their own values, I wouldn't say a Victorian moral values, but perhaps even more so Constantinopolitan sort of values of family, etc. So as we pop these staples which hold the Greek image together, there are many more layers that come beneath it, a more complex situation. Just if you have come across these things.
Okay, good, thank you. Can we take
two or three? Yes, thanks.
Good. Other questions as well, please. We take, gentlemen, we're going to, okay. Where is the microphone? Okay, you're nearer the gentleman at the back. It's just my way of giving you exercise, I'm sorry.
Hello, my name is Marios Falaris, and I'm a student of anthropology here. I was just wondering if you could speak a bit more on the refugee/migrant crisis. Refugee and migrant crisis, and the role, kind of what that highlights about transgressing nationality, religion, and such things as related to Greek identity.
Okay. And then we
take one more.
Sure. We can do different. There's a question, Bernard.
Right, Bernard Casey. I'm from LSE. I am not Greek, but an honorary German, and I'm an economist, not an anthropologist. But I did want...
You must have felt very comfortable to this evening.
I always enjoy myself at HO events. I wanted to ask about language and the use of language and how that influences thinking. And I'm going to come back to a point which I frequently make, which is, are we aware that in German the word for debt is the same as the word for guilt. And how does language, therefore, shape how we think, or how does the way that we think shape our language? Are the Germans behaving like perhaps the early Wittgenstein might say, or like the later Wittgenstein might think? Which is actually dominant? Is it the fact that the Germans can't think in any other way, or is it because that they think in a certain way, they then create a certain language which they impose upon others?
Mm-hmm. I take these three. Shall I do it from here? Yeah. Thank you, all three of you, for very interesting questions. And if I may say so, questions that give me a little bit more of an opportunity to grandstand, which I think is what you were very generously doing. So, yes, there were intellectuals in the 17th century and even earlier, in Byzantine times, who used the word Elines to describe themselves. It's very difficult when you say they called themselves Greeks, because then I want to know what the Greek word was. If it was Greki, it had other implications that most people who would have recognized themselves as Elines would not have accepted. But we do have lots of traveler witnesses from the 17th century on, in fact, that most of the ordinary people, especially in the countryside, did not use either of those words, but called themselves Romyi, and were more interested in the fact that they were Orthodox Christians. And actually, many of them spoke Romaica, which is more or less modern Greek, but they also spoke other languages. A lot of them spoke Turkish. I love telling my students, I don't understand why they make so much fuss about learning languages, since peasants in 17th century Greece actually could usually speak, in many cases, three or four languages, and could alternate among them quite comfortably. So the point I want to make is that what gets constructed is the idea of a monolithic and territorial Greece. There was, of course, the Meralia there, which was impossible territoriality, if you will, but it was a territorial dream. But that was a late development in that form. The Byzantine Empire, I think, is wrongly described as a Greek empire. Greeks were very important in the Byzantine Empire, but it's really much more accurate to call it the Byzantine Empire, just as I don't like the term Turkokratia for the description of the Ottoman period. So I certainly join you in calling for more historical precision. Obviously, in a presentation of this kind, you understand why I want to be a bit careful, because what I don't want to do is end up giving the impression that e pur si muove. No, that after all, the Greeks always had a notion of themselves as Greeks, because that already introduces an element of anachronism. And I think that precisely for the reasons of historical sensitivity that you've mentioned, we should do everything we can to avoid that. I'm going to come to the third question because it connects better with this one, and then come to the very important question about migrants. The way we think and the way we use language are, of course, inextricably mixed up with each other. As you, I'm sure, are aware, even if you insist on not being an anthropologist, there was the famous Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, according to which language so shaped our thought that we couldn't actually get outside it. Which makes no sense at all, because if that were true, we wouldn't even be able to learn a foreign language. As somebody who himself, as you can tell from my name, has a German background, but whose parents were told they were not German because they were not of the right racial descent, I probably grew up with a very strong antipathy to any form of essentialism, which is why I also become very angry when Greeks start talking about the Germans as Nazis. These kinds of simplifications help no one. And they overlook the fact, by the way, that Germany is the only country, as far as I know, that has actually erected monuments to its own shame. And I think that's something for which credit should be given. And I speak as the child of a family that certainly suffered greatly from that, from those events. But to come back to the point of language, there is a theory of linguistic performativity according to which the production of certain forms of rhetoric will be persuasive because it accords with certain kinds of conditions. And I would say that this also makes nonsense of the distinction between the material and the symbolic. Language is highly material because it has consequences in the real and experienced world.
And Holmes's argument about the current behavior of the ECB and other banking institutions is precisely that they have very cleverly figured out how to use language. You might suspect they had some anthropologists on the staff, and they might have. And he did ethnography inside the bank as well, so he was actually talking to the people who were involved in producing language that was quite intentionally directed toward producing the desired effects. And my feeling is that, unconsciously or otherwise, the most strident critics of Greece in the EU today are using the language of stereotypes to create a certain sense of what Greece is. And unfortunately, it's a runaway car. They're now on this disastrous train that is taking them into uncharted territory, because with the migrant situation, and see, now we can come back to that, with the migrant situation both in Greece and in Germany, and with Merkel having done, frankly, the decent thing by saying that she would take on, albeit for somewhat self-interested reasons, perfect illustration, by the way, of what Peter Luizos meant when he said that self-interest and affect were not incompatible. You take in these migrants because you know that Germany will have desperate need of young workers very soon if it's to sustain its current economic growth rate. But at the same time, this is a very unpopular move politically, and the only way that she can really deflect attention from that is by insisting that the frontline states, and especially Greece and Italy, must play a larger part. But if she does that, she now has to do something that Germany did not really do immediately after the Dublin Accords that put these countries at the front line, namely give them some money to do it with. So Germany is actually already beginning to give Greece money in order to deal with the migrant crisis. It's probably too little too late. But the other question is, what is that money being used for? Those who oppose immigration are saying it should be used to keep all these strangers out. They are essentializing people, saying they're not European, they will never be European because they're Muslim, because they believe in honor crimes, this, that, and the other. First of all, there are many European Muslims, and again, I categorically reject the idea that Europe is anything, is Christian, is Islamic, is Jewish. No, that doesn't make sense. Europe has a long history in which Christianity in its various forms has been the dominant religion. That doesn't mean that it always will be or must be. And I think it's only the discovery that Golden Dawn was worshipping the 12 Olympians that actually finally led the church to come to its senses and decouple itself a bit more clearly from Golden Dawn. So the way that language operates in this situation is that a performance of these stereotypes falls on receptive ears. It's not politically correct to be anti-Semitic, but right now it's politically correct to be anti-German. So we can say, I'm not a racist, but the Germans. Oh no, I'm just talking about the government. The Germans. And because there's that slippage between talking about a government and about a people, there's a real danger there. Now, I have to say that Greeks have been, in the past, unusually sensitive about making that distinction. I remember, my wife is American, I'm British. When we were living in Greece together, we were very struck by the fact that even at the height of the anti-Americanism that followed on the collapse of the junta and the revelations about CIA involvement, people were very careful to distinguish between you as an individual and your government. That is now suffering, that attitude. But it's suffering in part because, again, the performativity of the "you Greeks" rhetoric coming out of Berlin, coming out of Copenhagen, coming out of The Hague, is producing an echo in Greece. And that, in turn, and now I come to the second question, has a serious impact on the way in which the migration issue is held, because the migrants are also being stereotyped. They're being typecast as a kind of people we don't actually want to have here. I can understand why people feel worried when their customary way of life seems to them to be threatened, but it's a fact of life that all culture changes. That's, by the way, why anthropologists today will not talk about a culture or cultures. They'll talk about culture as a process, never, as I pointed out in the lecture, as a thing. And so the migrants now represent a moment both of fear and of opportunity for Greece. Fear that our culture is being destroyed and undermined by the arrival of all of these strange people, but the number of Chinese and Bangladeshi people who speak fluent Greek has actually made my performing flea act, and probably that of many of us in this room, you know, the foreigner who could actually speak Greek convincingly, much less interesting because there are so many of them. So Greece is already adapting to this new reality. It's being put under a lot of strain by this situation, and if you were living on Kos or Mytilene, two of the islands that are bearing the real brunt of these changes, the disproportionate numbers of the refugees is certainly creating a lot of resentment and fear. But it's also an opportunity because it allows the Greeks to examine more critically their claims not to being racist. Now, when I hear anyone say, "Deni me racistis, Allah, non sono razzista," però, you can do it in any number of languages, it always has that but element. And the but element is the danger, but it's also the opportunity, because then you, as a conscientious citizen, can say, but what? What about our situation when we were migrants in foreign lands? What about our claims that we're not racist? How can we sustain them in this kind of situation? And since 2009 in particular, I think the first 2 years of the crisis, people were just too numb to react in these kinds of ways. But what's interesting is that the worse it got, I think the more critical the public discourse became. So yes, you got more racism, and yes, you got more people voting for Golden Dawn, and that is a worrying situation that bears being very carefully watched. You also got acknowledgement that Greece was a crypto colony, maybe no longer so crypto, but certainly the victim of colonial power politics, and you got a recognition that perhaps Greekness was not the eternal verity that people had believed, but something to be enjoyed as a privilege in the present. And I repeat again that here we have a government that, against all expectations a few short years ago, has emerged. It made some serious mistakes, or maybe they were deliberate mistakes, we'll never know, in its first iteration. But the success of Greece at maintaining a genuine democratic alternation in the face of a disaster that has sent many other countries over the brink, and it's actually a lot to do with what's happened in Thailand, is something that Europe should be congratulating itself on, if some of the European leaders were not so determined to rip Europe apart for reasons that I think have more to do with the maintenance of their own self-interest.
Thanks. I think we've got time for another round of questions. Can I invite another gentleman here, please?
I'm Platon Tinios. I'm visiting here the LSE from Greece. Looking at the situation from the inside out, from the inside of the country out, these stereotypes you hear from Bild and the German newspapers are certainly annoying and very simplistic, but again, looking at it from the inside of Greece out, isn't it also simplistic to characterize the Greek problem as something which is the result of foreign influence and the Greeks as innocent victims led astray by the international capital, and hence, and that Greece would be a paradise if it was not for foreign influence? And I'll just, if I may speak a little longer, I think a very interesting parallel, a very interesting contrast is to look at social insurance, which is my own field, and to ponder that the ICA, the main social insurance foundation, was actually founded at the same time as US Social Security, basically on the same lines. I mean, they're both creatures of the 1930s, with the cutting edge of social insurance technology in the 1930s, and then contrast what happened to ICA in the following 70 years and to the US social security system. ICA is on its last legs. It might well be abolished very in the next few months. And this is something that for which explanations were stressing outside influences, I think, are very are not credible.
Okay, good. I wonder, Michael, if I could perhaps insert a question of my own there, which would be comparative. Let me make a slightly flippant comment, though, because I've clearly understood from the lecture that we shouldn't stereotype. But I noticed that when you came out of the airport, you were surprised by the orderly queue standing for the taxis. But let's,
a palpable hit.
Let's move on. There's always a but in the phrase.
Yeah.
What strikes me is that you have a very powerful argument about our sense of Greekness, our Western mm-hmm. sense of Greekness. Why do we see such powerful stereotyping in the Greek case, far more than the other bailout states in the euro crisis? If we think Portugal, if we think Cyprus, even if we think Cyprus, Ireland, other bailout states, it can't be simply the magnitude of the fact that Greece has had three bailouts, because we could have put this in the period at the very beginning of the crisis, and we would still find that Bild as a magazine was highlighting something about Greekness when they didn't do the same for the other bailout states. So there's clearly something about Western European images of Hellenism, of Greece, which don't replicate to the other cases. Yeah. So I'm going to now pass to another question from the audience, if you could just accept that as part of the
question
plan.
In the front.
Dalia here, please.
Thank you. I felt very comfortable with your lecture.
Sorry, is it working?
Really loud, Dalia.
Because I'm coming from political and cultural psychology, and just hearing you talk about moralism, it makes me think of a parallel, like the way AIDS, for example, was first understood by people, and the effort to find some kind of moralization, it was homosexuals or people who were sexually promiscuous, whose fault it was, so some kind of need to find a scapegoat and materialize all the bad. So maybe the crisis takes this form and common sense. Thank you.
I think I'll take these three. Yes.
You can do that all in about 4 minutes, Mike.
Quite difficult, but I'll do my best. Stereotypes are indeed simplistic, and it is wrong to characterize a crisis as foreign-induced. I would argue that that's exactly why we need a militant middle ground. I may have slipped a little bit one way or another, and I think Kevin's point about the... there's also slippage between my role as an anthropologist trying to be as dispassionate as possible and my own feelings, which were indeed of surprise, but it was a valuable corrective, in fact, because I think Greeks are just as capable as anyone else of being orderly, but I guess I hadn't realized how little I had appreciated of that at the time. The constant Greek theme, it's the xenodactylo, and especially on the left, has been, I think, a distortion, but so has the refusal of more powerful countries to recognize their role. And so on the principle that I think as academics we have a moral duty to make sure that the voices that are not heard can now be heard through our intervention. Just as I would make the same argument that I made about Macedonia, where I said, of course I could get Greece into trouble by making critical comments about its refusal to adopt the principle of self-determination. So what I did instead was to say, but the Macedonian minority suffers much more than the Greek government, but I want to point out the role of the Western powers in pushing the Greeks towards this essentialist view of themselves. So I think that the militant middle ground is, as you see, a very difficult space, and it needs its militancy to stop being pushed one way or the other. In the same way, when you encounter your own tendencies to stereotype, and we all do it all the time, I would actually argue that all social life is a process of stereotype trading. The point is, when does it become excessive? And when is it damaging? So just as I tell my graduate students, the sentence you should always have over your door is, who does what to whom and why? So I think my sense that it was rather fun to get into a scrimmage with Greeks in a queue for a taxi wasn't all that hostile. When it's used as an excuse to say that the Greeks can't run their economy and therefore we should take it over, that becomes a much more serious matter. And finally, I mean, this whole question of the bad image, this is exactly what I mean by cultural intimacy, that every society has areas of its cultural life that it tries to shield from outsiders. And my book on cultural intimacy, which, by the way, is about to appear in a third edition, a much rewritten edition, because now I have much more comparative purchase for my work on Thailand and China and other places. But the argument is that no nation state actually can exist without a certain degree of illegality, as I mentioned in the talk, and without, in fact, many of the misbehaviors that are officially forbidden. So a former student of mine, Andreas Glaser, now teaching sociology at the University of Chicago, argues in his book about, an article published in 2004, that one reason, probably not the only reason, but one important reason for which the GDR collapsed had less to do with financial problems and the withdrawal of Soviet support. Actually, it's not clear by that point whether the Soviet Union was bankrolling Germany, the GDR, or the other way around. It had something to do with the fact that the Stasi were very, very effective at cancelling out anything that looked like slightly amoral behavior, and therefore removed everything that was part of the fun and games of everyday life. And in the same way, I would argue that a small and low level of nudge, nudge, wink, wink, we know what goes on, is actually what creates nationalistic support. And I think my work is very much of a critique of that, of people like Gellner and Anderson and others, in that they take the nationalistic ideology at face value in each case. My view is that people remain loyal to a country that allows them to be just naughty enough. And so all of these negative images are not actually negative internally. They're actually enjoyed. And I think we all know what we mean by that. I see a lot of knowing looks, and I would say, at the risk of perhaps being accused of stereotyping again, that Greeks are very good at this game. In part, I would say, for a very practical and observable reason, that if you feel that everything you do is observed not only by your government, but by their patrons in Western European countries, if you are being held by to what I sometimes call the global hierarchy of value, then the pleasures of minor disobedience become all the more important, and they actually become a source of solidarity, which is why during the Kalamboki scandal in Greece, for example, or some of the more recent revelations, Greeks didn't chastise their government. They said, okay, go for it if you can, but the bad thing is to be caught out.
And why do we stereotype Greece more than the Portuguese?
Yes, that's right. Sorry, I didn't address that. Because only the Greeks have been typecast as the ancestors of Europe. And being typecast as an ancestor actually removes you from power, because it removes you from modernity. This is what Johannes Fabian called the denial of coevalness, right? They're being put into another space. This is being done on an international level. Thailand is a bit that way in that the Western, I don't think Thailand is as stereotyped by its neighbors, but Thailand is very much stereotyped in the West as a certain kind of country, and the Thai government plays up to this, the land of smiles and so on. What they don't tell you is that in Thai culture, there's a lot of difference between smiling like this, and smiling like this, right? And it's something you learn as you learn the language. You develop a whole new vocabulary of movements as well. And you start to realize that the self-stereotyping that is a response in large measure to the need for tourism revenue in this case actually conceals something else. So in the same way, I think the fact that the Greeks have been castigated so much comes from a disconnect, certainly, between the official self-image and what people discover when they deal with Greeks. What they discover when they deal with Greeks is, my God, they're just like us, and we can't admit it. So there's, I think, the reason. The Greeks actually pose the most fundamental challenge to the rationalistic self-image that has been, in my view, the biggest albatross around the neck of Europe.
Thank you. That's a wonderful theme to finish on. We're out of time. I apologize for that. But can you please join me in thanking Michael for this evening's lecture?